Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to a Decoding TV bonus episode. I'm David Chen. I'm here with Patrick Klepek. Patrick, good morning. How's it going today?
It's good. How are you doing?
I'm excited to dive into today's topic with you. Now, as people who have been listening to Decoding TV for a while may already be aware, Patrick Klepek is going to be my co-host on Decoding TV for the foreseeable future. And so we're getting the old bonus content machine revved up again. Really excited to do that. Yeah, Patrick's making the bonus content noises to simulate that what's going on. And so what we are trying to do with some of the bonus episodes is just talk about stuff that's in the news that we're interested in and passionate about. And so today we're going to be discussing a new article at Vulture called The Decomposition of Rotten Tomatoes. I want to say a few things before we kick this conversation off, which is, I have a standing offer out to Patrick. Hey, anything that catches your attention that you want to talk about, let's talk about it. So Patrick sent this article to me days ago. He's like, hey, let's talk about this in bonus. And I agreed. I have since talked about this on other podcasts that I also host. But I still think it's valuable to discuss it because there's a lot to dive into and Patrick will provide a different perspective. But I just wanted people to have some context for why I am talking about it here on the bonus Decoding TV episode. The other thing I want to mention is that these bonus episodes are free for the foreseeable future. Although if you are a paid subscriber at decodingtv.com, you get early access as well as ad-free access. And eventually, the plan is that they will be behind a Decoding TV paid subscriber wall. So you get it for free for now. And if you're enjoying it, you want to support what we're doing on Decoding TV, hopefully you'll become a paid subscriber at decodingtv.com. All right, Patrick, let's get into it. Vulture published this piece by Lane Brown with reporting by Luke Winky called The Decomposition of Rotten Tomatoes. Subhead, the most overrated metric in movies is erratic, reductive, and easily hacked, and yet has Hollywood in its grip. I think I would describe the issues that this article details, I would put them into two buckets. One is the problem with the fact that Rotten Tomatoes exists and is important. So that is one bucket, and like why that is problematic. And the second bucket I would identify is things that PR firms and studios are doing to juice their film's Rotten Tomatoes scores, right? That's kind of the two big things that the article brings up for me. Let me know if you think there's another category of thing I missed. But let's start with the first thing, which is the importance of Rotten Tomatoes, why it seems to have such a place of primacy. Patrick Klepek, you come from the world of video games, and I think you are also dealing with this issue, which is to say numerical grades, letter grades being put on art, aggregators that combine all those things, and this kind of being a tyrannical structure under which to try to do interesting reporting and do interesting criticism, right? Like, talk about your entanglements with things like Rotten Tomatoes and Metacritic in the past.
Yeah, so the equivalent of, yeah, Rotten Tomatoes in video games, as you pointed out, is Metacritic. And I don't think you can entangle the relationship I've had with Metacritic. I say, like, I'd be more like a journal we as, like, video game critics, journalists, like, running media organizations, working at media organizations, from the economies of running those websites. I think if you talk to most folks that have written a review, they don't like putting the number at the end, whether it's a letter grade or any number of different grading systems, 3 stars, 5 stars, you know, A to F, whatever the case is, it feels very reductionist for the work you've put in and also very arbitrary for assigning it to the work that you're judging or interpreting itself, because whatever your definition of a C or a B or an A is going to be often different than the audience, and getting on an even level with that between the writer, the critic, the audience is extremely difficult. The problem is the fastest way to get people talking about something that you've written is to assign a grade to it, whatever metric you want to choose. And in a media environment in which it's increasingly difficult to get people to read things, to click on things, to stay on a website long enough for an ad impression to become full and pay out the way you would like it to, you need people to talk about something. And so you can wax poetic for 2,000, 3,000 words about Starfield or whatever the game might be. The thing that people start with, and I have this impulse just as like guilty as anyone else, is like sometimes you might scroll down to the end and like see what the kind of where they fell on it and then go back up. And people like to argue over the scores. People like to share the scores. PR firms like to put the scores into marketing. And so there is this entire machine around the very specific like qualitative interpretation of a work that I think you've seen over a lot of institutions and games step back from. Like, hey, we're not doing review scores. If you want to read the review, look, read the conclusion. You can get if you want, like, what did we think? It's probably in that last paragraph. And if you want the extra detail, you can find it in the rest of the review. But I don't think you can entangle economics from the rise and continued persistence of scoring mechanisms. And I think there is a lot of echoes in that in Hollywood being tied up with Rotten Tomatoes. And the last point I would make is that it's not just the economies of running media, it's the economies of running game developers. I mean, most famously, I believe, the developers of Fallout New Vegas, Obsidian, had their bonuses tied to their Metacritic score. And I might have some of the details on this wrong, but either applies to this scenario or it definitely applies to other scenarios. They missed it by a point because any number of reviews got them, let's say, from a 90, which was the number that they needed to hit by their publisher, to an 89. And because of those arbitrary scores, those arbitrary interpretations, a bunch of people who probably crunched and exploited themselves to ship like a classic video game didn't get their bonuses. And so that's different than what's tied up here financially, but I think they speak to similar sorts of entanglements of economies and labor and art that I think are driving a lot of the conversation around this piece itself.
Yeah, I was aware that sometimes I think it's usually the publisher sets an incentive around the Metacritic score,
yeah.
Right? The idea is basically that, hey, we're paying this studio to make this game, and we will pay you this much if you make the game and deliver it on time, and we'll pay you this much more if the game is good. And the way we measure if the game is good is by Metacritic score. So it's like a quick
Correct.
Way of determining whether the game is good. On the one hand, the need and desire for some ostensibly objective metric to evaluate something, it's very understandable. It's like, hey, you can't just deliver like a terrible game, or you can't deliver a terrible product and have no consequences for it. On the other hand, it's really upsetting when, as you said, it feels wrong when it's tied to financial incentives, and it particularly feels bad when it's tied to financial incentives or it's tied to a score that feels like it can be easily hacked. And in the case of Rotten Tomatoes, that's kind of what this article lays out. Now, in the film world, the incentives are very different, right? It's rare that there's a situation where a studio will say to a director, make this movie, and if it gets a 90% Rotten Tomatoes, we'll give you a bonus. I've never heard of anything like that happening before.
Uh-huh.
But the article does detail stuff that is similar to that, like kind of adjacent to that. For instance, I'm reading here from the article. Between October 2018 and January 2019, Rotten Tomatoes added 8 reviews to Ophelia's score. This is an indie film. 7 were favorable, and most came from critics who had reviewed at least one other Bunker 15 movie. Now, Bunker 15 is the PR firm that does a lot of this Rotten Tomatoes score hacking, as described in the article. What happens then is that as a result of like some of the scores that have been introduced, Ophelia climbs the tomato meter to 62%, flipping from rotten to fresh. The next month, the distributor IFC Films announced that it had acquired Ophelia for release in the US, end quote, right? So the idea is that like maybe for a smaller indie film, If you can get that tomato meter score a little bit higher, it's probably not the decisive factor for somebody deciding to acquire the movie and distribute it, but it's probably an input. Do you know what I'm saying? And a distribution deal with a company like IFC is A, financially beneficial, B, has huge career implications because it means people can see your movie. It means you might get the next movie based off of people seeing this one. So it's a little bit different, right? And some people also think that Rotten Tomato scores can impact box office, like that people will look at the Rotten Tomato score, the tomato meter, and then decide whether or not they're going to go see a movie. This is like a lot harder to measure, and it's a subject of much dispute. But I guess I wanted to affirm what Patrick's saying, which is that there's kind of financial incentives attached in various ways to scores on art. Now, Patrick, you were talking about how we would love for people to just consume the nuanced, you know, 8-page article. But instead, they spend a lot of time arguing about scores. First of all, one could argue that – I mean, I guess I'm curious – where do you come out on that? Are you in favor of scores? And you know, if I don't want to pin you to a specific position, but I'm curious. Like, are you in favor of scores? You know, like, and are you, and how do you feel about aggregators putting all the scores together?
Personally, I don't have a problem with scores because I like the arbitrary nature of them in that it forces you to sort of commit to something in the same way that I enjoy doing top 10 lists at the end of the year and not having it be my 10 favorite movies in no particular order. No, order it. Stop being a coward. Like, pick one that's number one. And the reason is because I like my own value structure to then interpret how works meant to me. And like the order, while certainly arbitrary and the score is certainly arbitrary, it does like help me process some of how I feel about a work and how I reflect on it, like especially when I'm looking back at the end of the year. But as a culturally, I think they're an albatross. I think like they should not exist. I don't think they help anything. I think they broadly are just a net negative and aren't really helping anything but like fill in like the graphics you'll see after a movie or a game comes out and like plastered with all of the scores and the little quotes that go associated with it. Like I don't think it's helping anything, but I personally haven't really minded it, but I think most organizations, there's a reason they have trended towards removing scores, because they're willing to give up frankly some of the vitriol. Because if you are that critic that is out on the limb that says like, it's so much different to like Starfield, which is like the biggest release the last couple of weeks. If you don't like that game and you give it a 3 out of 10, the vitriol you're going to get, the death threats you're going to get are so different than if you wrote 4 sentences at the end and said, I don't think this game was very good. There is an emotional reaction that the grading, the number scores, which I think is tied up in like this broader fanboy, like fandom culture that I think has accelerated in our social media age. And then scores are weaponized by audiences as part of these different fan cultures. And so I think this stuff all gets tied up together, where the reason to put a score on something is an incentive to be caught up in the fandom and these culture wars that are occurring over these works. And that will hopefully, as a byproduct, drive traffic and interest to the website that you're running. And so the incentives for doing it are really toxic. And the incentives for doing like the positive reasons for doing it, like are really, you start running out of them when you try to count them on your hand. And I think those lessons broadly apply to interpreting and observing all media, even though like my experience broadly has been in video games.
It's interesting. I think what you're referring to, like Starfield, huge controversy this week or last week, I guess, when GameSpot and IGN, two of the biggest outlets in the video game space, gave Starfield probably one of the biggest games of the fall, if not the game event of the year.
Sure.
They gave that game a 7 out of 10. I saw Starfield 7 out of 10 was trending on X.com.
Bad.
People really up in arms. And I think it's a great observation, Patrick, to connect it to fandom culture. The idea being that people take art so personally these days.
Mm-hmm.
They think, hey, the art that I consume and that I like represents me. Like, it's me in some way. I'm connected to this art. And if you don't like the art, you are judging me. You're judging the art, but you're also judging me, right? And or possibly judging my curatorial skills, like judging my taste. Because like, because right. If you don't like it and I think it's good, then you're saying, I don't know what I'm talking about, right? That's not the truth, though. That's not the reality. The reality is people are different. They have different opinions. They recognize different elements in art. They relate to it differently. They experience it differently. It's all a wonderful tapestry, and we should celebrate all of it, Patrick Klepek. but it feels so focused and personal when it comes to video games. Like, I'm not saying film critics have not received death threats before. Like, it just feels like the frequency and order of magnitude just feels so much higher in the video game space. It's very, you know, I'm old enough to remember when people were getting upset that, you know, Armand White or whatever was ruining
right.
Toy Story 3's Rotten Tomatoes score or something like whatever movie of the day it was, you know, like, so that stuff definitely happened in the film world, but it's, in my opinion, way less prevalent today. Whereas now it feels like it's even more prevalent in the video game world. But yeah, it's interesting to kind of consider that. I think it's less Rotten Tomatoes because it's it is kind of the standard. Like, there's no real IGN equivalent in the movie world. Yes, IGN does write movie reviews. Siddhartha Dlaka is a freaking genius. You know, past and hopefully future Decoding TV co-host, like, I read his work religiously, and I think he's amazing. But I don't think that, like, IGN occupies the same space in the movie world as it does in the video game world, right?
Yeah, I think that's true.
And so as a result, like, there is no equivalent of IGN. Like, maybe if the New York Times gave something a bad review, you know, like, that might be equivalent. But, like, I think that, you know, one of the things identified in this article is that film critics just as – like, the importance of film critics in the culture has just faded dramatically over the course of the last couple decades. You know, last generation had people like Pauline Kael and people that were, like, legendary people that could make or break a movie. And that just does not exist anymore. In its place, we have aggregators and algorithms, right? That's what we have in its place. I agree with you that culturally, it is a net loss for us. Like, it is bad for us that is happening. But it's also the reality that many of us live with, which is that if you put a score, your review will get more clicks, right? And if your review gets more clicks, it's more likely, maybe it's more likely that you'll stay employed or be compensated for, you know, or whatever it is. Like, we are incentivized towards these forces that we don't necessarily agree with. But it's interesting your attitude on it, Patrick, which is that you appreciate the constraints. And I feel the same way. It's like tweets. Remember when tweets were first a thing?
Yeah.
You would write a tweet and it's like, hey, there's some art. There's something creatively rewarding about taking your thoughts and trying to, like, compress them into a small package, right? Like, and similarly, making a top 10, there's something like, creatively, there's something invigorating about, like, saying, like, hey, if I had to sum this all up, what would it be? Into a tweet, into a number, into a score, you know, whatever it is. So anyway, so that's some of the reflections about, like, the score as having primacy. I don't think it's going to go away. Like, I don't think there's anything we can do to make it go away. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, Rotten Tomatoes is a key factor in marketing, in people's purchasing decisions. And I don't know what, like, other than not talking about it, which most critics don't already, you know, I don't know what can be done about it. Do you think anything can be done about it, Patrick, before we move on?
You know, I mean, one of the things that I have seen this consistently in some of the wider discussion around this, and there is, I think there's some, you know, quotes from the director, Paul Schrader, in the piece that point to this, where there's definitely a running observation. I think this is more like in the filmmaking community than anywhere else, of like, well, the viewing public is lazy. Like, that's part of how we've gotten here. It's like, these lazy motherfuckers just don't even know how to watch the good stuff. And I do feel like that's the vibe. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And look, I'm sympathetic to that view, but to push back on that, there's too much stuff, right? Like, I think part of the prevalence of Rotten Tomatoes, the desperation to grasp onto anything that can give you a sense of, is this worth my time, is because we live in an age in which there isn't free time. Like, you can fill that with something, anything. There is always a thing you can watch or play and to live in an age of infinite consumption creates a world in which people are going to grasp onto weird things to figure out what exactly they should be watching, or they should be playing, or they should be listening to. And so I think it's a symptom of like a larger, frankly, a sickness. Like, there's just too much stuff, honestly. Like, it's bad. Like, it makes it very difficult as a viewer to grasp on to anything or for anything. Like, there's a reason so few works, this applies to all media, like, manage to have, like, in your words, like, cultural relevance, because there's too much culture. And it's cool that so many things are being made, but I also think it leads to a situation where, for the audience, well, what am I supposed to watch? It used to be easier, where it's like, here are the big things, watch these, pick the one that appeals to you. And now that everything targets every micro demographic, every like niche interest, I think part of the reason the studios are so tied up in this is because at least it's an objective metric. Is it doing anything? We're not exactly sure, but it's something. And like, marketing, the big revolution of marketing in the last 15 years is being able to target, right? Where like in the past, like, you put up the billboards, you put up the trailers. Is it doing anything? I don't know. We'll see what the box office tells us. Whereas now you can literally track people and their behavior. And I think part of Rotten Tomatoes is an extension of this addiction to precisely knowing people's habits and what you can expect from them. And when you don't, you're going to find literally anything you can to solve that problem. And I think Rotten Tomatoes is one of those. We're like, at least it's a metric. We're not sure of the science to point to, like, is movie that was good and going to be a box office hit was going to do those things regardless of the Rotten Tomatoes. Like, the article seems to lay out, like, it's inconclusive at best. But if you're like working at a studio and you're talking to your bosses, like, but we can point to this number, like, number good. I see how we arrive at an obsession over it when you're being expected to deliver results, or at least anything that folks can grasp on.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Yeah, you know, there's a little bit about the flaws of the Rotten Tomatoes system in the article. Like, for instance, Rotten Tomatoes just tells you if critics liked it or not. They don't tell you how much they liked it. quote, there's no accounting for enthusiasm, no attempt to distinguish between extremely and slightly positive or negative reviews. That means a film can score a perfect 100 with just passing grades. In other words, like, if everyone barely liked it, it's 100% on Rotten Tomatoes, right? But that would not...
Well,
that would,
even Schrader at the end points out, like, there was a review of one of his works, and it was like, the person thought it was interesting. Didn't really work, but, like, thought it was interesting. And that's a negative review. It's like, is that a negative
review? Right, exactly. It's obviously this binary system that compresses everything. But yeah, a publicist says, in the old days, if an independent film got all three-star reviews, that's like the kiss of death. With Rotten Tomatoes, if you get all three-star reviews, it's fantastic, end quote. That's amazing. Did you see this Richard Linklater interview, Patrick Klepek?
I've seen a quote going around.
Yeah.
I believe it was alongside what I was just talking about.
Yeah. Richard Linklater has made a new movie called Hitman. Apparently, it's amazing. I can't wait to see it. He did an interview with The Hollywood Reporter, and Hollywood Reporter asked him the question, you're such a pioneer of American indie cinema. Do you think a career like the one you've cut out for yourself and enjoyed over the years is possible today? And Richard Linklater responds, it feels like it's gone with the wind or gone with the algorithm. Sometimes I'll talk to some of my contemporaries who I came up with during the 90s and we'll go, oh my God, we could never get that done today. I'm just going to skip through his response because it's pretty long. But he says, with a changing culture and changing technology, it's hard to see cinema slipping back into the prominence it once held. I think we could feel it coming on when they started calling films content, but that's what happens when you let tech people take over your industry. It's hard to imagine indie cinema in particular having the cultural relevance that it did. It's hard to imagine the whole culture is going to be on the same page about anything, much less filmmaking. We can be self-absorbed and say it's just about cinema, but it's really all of our modern cultural life. You could say the same thing about reading books. A lot of young people can't read a book because they're just on their phones. Some really intelligent, passionate, good citizens just don't have the same need for literature and movies anymore. It doesn't occupy the same space in the brain. I think that's just how we've given our lives over our lives largely to this thing that depletes the need for curating and filling ourselves up with meaning from art and fictional worlds. That need has been filled up with, let's face it, advanced delivery systems for advertising. It's sad, but what can you do? I also don't want to go through life thinking our best days are behind us. That's just not productive. So in your own area, you just have to persist and do what you can on behalf of the things that you believe in. You have to believe that everything can change and that things can go back to being a little bit better. Can't we just go back to being a little better? End quote. Powerful words from Richard Linklater. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, despite the fact that we acknowledge that there are economic and financial realities to needing to put a score on or the audience wanting that or that expediting the work, I think it's safe to say that Patrick and I put work out into the world that we believe in, you know, and certainly, you know, on the Filmcast, we don't use any numerical scores or grades or anything like that, despite people having requested that in the past. I don't believe you do on Remap or Waypoint. Like, I don't remember that. Right. Yeah. It's just like we appreciate a long, nuanced discussion that doesn't just be like, hey, it gets an A or, you know, anything like that.
Should just have people guess it at the end. What do you think?
Yeah. What do you think the score was? Exactly.
Communicated. And then we'll aggregate that. And like, it turns out the Waypoint audience thought this was a B+.
Yes. It could be a fun little game for yourself. So,
but I thought that that comment from him, I think, is actually a really thoughtful articulation of this broader issue, which I think sometimes is smashed down to like young people are lazy and like don't want this stuff anymore. And I think tying that into the economic realities of technology, algorithms, you know, straight up addiction to phones, like the fact that everything is at your fingertips, thus leading to a lack of curiosity or need for curiosity, I think is a really smart observation that doesn't necessarily, it looks at like, look at the systemic problems. Don't blame the individual people for like how we've arrived here. Cause it is rarely the blame of like the 18-year-old for how we've gotten here. The system has led the 18-year-old to these types of habits. And some people can break out of that and some people can fit into those old classical models. But, you know, I mean, I'll be curious if you know, like I haven't seen it yet, but I know that you all at the Filmcast really liked it. But Talk to Me, like a really successful independent horror film this summer, like those guys came from YouTube. It's like, is that, if not a new path for indie filmmaking than what is. And I just wonder if part of what we're at here is like generational crossroads on what it means to be an indie filmmaker, where you make your mark, like where that work lives. You know, Quentin Tarantino lamenting that he doesn't read critics anymore. It's like, well, you know, we had conversation recently on a recent bonus episode about, you know, the rise of like TikTok critics and like, what do we call them? And it's like, well, yeah. If the medium is changing and you're uninterested in what the new medium is, your initial response is going to be, well, this change is bad and they're not doing things the way that we used to do. Thus, I don't like it. And it can be true. Like it can be true that there are problems with the new system, but sometimes it can be also that the system changed and you haven't, which I think is interesting.
Yeah. I think with regards to this quote, it's really on the money when he says like that this kind of desire has been replaced with advanced ad delivery mechanisms, of which one could argue Rotten Tomatoes is one, right?
Yeah.
And you're right about all that stuff you said, Patrick, about the culture and how it all ties in together. Why watch 8 movies if you can just look at a score and then decide to watch one, right? Like, why should I need to try and stumble my way through the world if I can just look at a number and that can dictate what my choices are? Because it's so much easier. It's so much simpler that way. And I have too much stuff to consume anyway, right? So it's all kind of connected with each other. All right, Patrick, we've talked for a really long time about just kind of the overall place that Rotten Tomatoes and these scores hold in the culture. I should point out the article also points to some tactics that PR firms utilize to increase Rotten Tomato scores. I have heard tell of these in the past, Patrick. I have heard tell of whispers. Some of these. Specifically, the idea of, hey, talking with either Rotten Tomatoes or a specific outlet to get an existing review flipped from negative to positive.
Like that's wild.
Because the Paul Schrader example, it's like, hey, they might contact Rotten Tomatoes. They're like, hey, we read this Paul Schrader review and it seems pretty positive to us. You know, like here's like mm-hmm. six lines they said about how good it is. And they can, and that's like, to me, I think that's like kind of underhanded, but still like well within the bounds of, if you're operating in this system in which there is a forced binary, then I think it's well within the bounds of being okay to like argue your case that this is a positive review and not a negative review.
And Rotten Tomatoes, can you answer this for me? Is Rotten Tomatoes and the people that work there, are they the ones interpreting a review as positive or negative, or does the critic declare it positive or negative when it goes into their system?
My understanding is it can be both. Understanding. I believe it can be submitted as such, but also that if nothing is submitted or if it's ambiguous, that Rotten Tomatoes can make a decision about. I may be wrong about that, so apologies if that's the case.
Okay,
but I think it would be very that's my understanding, but. Feel free to correct me at decodingtv@gmail.com or in the comments if that's wrong. I'll pin the comment. But the thing that goes too far, in my opinion, is there are examples of movies that have low Rotten Tomato scores, and then people, filmmakers, PR studio, PR firms, or studios will pay lesser known reviewers to write reviews that are likely to be positive. Like that pay to play, I think, goes a little bit too far. Patrick, I don't know if you've encountered this in the video game space where people will pay for video game reviews. I've heard of that happening. Like recently, Microsoft admitted to the existence of ghost reviewers. Like they'll pay, like there'll be a game coming out and they'll pay people to like review it so they know what the scores will be when it comes out.
That is just called consulting.
Exactly.
Like one of the oldest ways, if you have been in my position where you've been a writer, reporter, journalist, whatever kind of like, you know, bucket you fell into, frequently what happens is that you kind of age out of the job because they can't pay you enough to like sustain like having a family, buying a house, that sort of thing, especially for jobs being in California and New York so frequently. And so what often happens is like, hey, I've spent 20 years building up this skill set. what do I do? And one of the more common ones is to get into consulting, where I've never done any projects like this. I almost got into this before the Remap stuff worked itself out, because there is a lot of money to be made in the consulting side, because much like the Rotten Tomatoes, and this article talks about working with certain consulting firms that can help you try and figure out what is your movie potentially going to score on Rotten Tomatoes. It's a similar sort of thing where you'll be brought in to play a game and write what's called a mock review. So you write a review the same way that you'd be writing it for a publication. It's just for internal purposes. And I don't know this for a fact, and probably each company is different. I've never done one of these personally, but often I think you're meant to give it a score so they can have a sense of like, where is this game going to land with critics? And it's like, if you have done this a long time, you can probably give them a good sense that, like, you know, like most people are probably going to give this game a 7 or 8 out of 10. And so it is very common for game companies to pay former game critics to consult on products ahead of release. And that is a story as old as time for the last, you know, 15, 20 years for game critics that no longer have full-time jobs in the media space to do work like that.
Extremely reasonable decision for a company to take.
Yep.
Where that becomes a problem is if that score is included in the Metacritic.
That is true. I can be surprised about a lot of things, but as far as I know, that is never anything that is working its way into Metacritic. And OpenCritic are the two main. OpenCritic was kind of developed in response to criticisms of Metacritic. As far as I know, nothing like that has ever happened. Do I think that game companies are trying to tilt the scales by dangling early access to a game to a smaller outlet that is like more likely to give it a positive review? Well, yeah, but that's also the job of a PR person. Like, you know what I mean? Like at the end of the day, like so much of my issue with things like Metacritic or even Rotten Tomatoes is the lack of accountability and like that's happening on the platform itself. Because the platforms, well, they're enjoying the divisiveness. Like they win either way. And there's actually really not a ton of incentive for them to improve themselves, because like being a horrible platform, I mean, I don't know if the economics or like the financial viability of Rotten Tomatoes like is, I don't know how much money it generates, but as a cultural artifact or object, obviously you want to be important to a lot of people who value you. And that is clearly true of Rotten Tomatoes, regardless of its flaws.
Yeah. It's also important to know that I believe it shares a parent company with Universal Pictures as well as Fandango. So Rotten Tomatoes is part of the same company that makes movies and also sells tickets to movies. So just
red flag,
I think they're calling that a beige flag these days in the modern culture. No, I'm just joking. But a lot of the article talks about this this PR firm called Bunker 15. And Bunker 15 is like a PR firm that is able to like juice Rotten Tomatoes scores. Here is the quote from Bunker 15 about paying critics to write reviews. Quote, "We have thousands of writers in our distribution list. A small handful have set up a specific system where filmmakers can sponsor or pay to have them review a film," end quote. So it does happen. Now, I think you're right. Now, you're saying you've never heard of that happening in video games. Maybe you're right. Obviously, in the film world, it does happen. Like, this is confirmed in the article that, like,
some. And that's bad.
Yeah, and that's bad. That's bad. Now, there's also other ways of juicing the scores, right? Like, some of the techniques described in the article are, hey, if the movie had a good debut somewhere and it has a really high score, don't screen it again. Don't screen it again because you don't want to mess with the score, right? Like, that's a very easy way to, like, control the score. Or screen it only for people who are likely to like it, you know? Or, you know, like, there's all these ways that people can manipulate the scores, most of which I think are, like, fair game. I think as an audience member, there's just a couple takeaways I think you should have. Number one, don't trust the Rotten Tomatoes score of any movie. At least not unilaterally. You know, you can use that as one input, but know that it is easily manipulated. And number two, find people that you trust online. And if you're listening to this, you probably trust me and Patrick Klepek.
So, at least one of us.
At least one of us. Find people you trust online and go, you know, like listen to them and see what they have to say about a specific film or a video game or a TV show or whatever. I think that the media of the future that is going to be thriving and interesting is going to be personality driven. It's going to be personality based. It's going to be about establishing connections to listeners, readers, viewers, and going from there, as opposed to, you know, that will be the most rewarding sort of cultural commentary I think that's going to exist. Less so, here's a number, now go see Transformers 9. You know, like that to me, doesn't sound like a very rewarding relationship personally, but maybe it works. Yeah, but it clearly works for a lot of people, you know?
Yeah. And I think it really ties into like, you can see the cycle that happens where, you know, a movie or a game or a TV show gets certain scores and then it feeds into like the YouTube algorithm, right? Cause then people make videos about those scores, which feeds into pre-existing like algorithms that are going to favor like hate and anger and divisiveness. And the moment you click on one of those, even out of morbid curiosity, you're going to get recommended more of those. And there are just, there are horrible incentive structures all around that are constantly rewarding behavior that is going to make people upset. I think when you have that algorithmic behavior that financially rewards dividing people, that collides with the rise of really intense personal identity fandom culture. Like, I'm not shocked that things are this like bad sometimes, because those are just things that are, they're going to intermingle, but in the worst possible ways. And I think we are just, as like our social media gets more intimate, right? Like you can see that, but like between like Facebook, Twitter, TikTok, like if you just watch like how different platforms have rose, they always get more intimate. And thus, as they get more intimate, you have more parasocial relationships with people. You have people rewarded for being personal and open, which is just further tying your own identity to the thing that someone else is putting out. And there can be a lot that you get out of that. Like, you look, you and I are, you know, have carved out careers in what I hope are like healthy, like versions of these kinds of relationships. But it is absolutely the case that a lot of these are or can lead to unhealthy relationships. And I think it's just really, I think it's going to get worse before it gets better. I don't know what the better version of that is, other than you and I continuing to model a great way of running these things. And more people should do that.
I think what you're trying to say is everything I just said prior to that was BS. Because there's a lot of downsides with parasocial relationships as well. So I guess there's just no hope for any of us, really, in this space.
The faster you embrace that, David, then you know the better off we'll all be. We'll just start at the floor and climb our way up like we're going in that TV show Silo. Just one step at a time.
Somebody in the chat, Joe, is saying, Dave isn't my best friend. Joe, I have some bad news for you. Anyway,
it's a new tier that we're introducing at Decoding TV, the Dave's best friend tier, for the low, low price of.
Well, anyway, we hope you've enjoyed this chat and welcome your feedback at decodingtv@gmail.com. You know, we're trying to create something that is going to be compelling for listeners and more importantly, compelling for paid subscribers. So if this is something you want to see more of, or if this is something you find compelling, we would love to hear about it at decodingtv@gmail.com. Find more of Patrick's work at crossplay.news, where he writes his newsletter, as well as at Remap Radio, wherever podcasts can be found. And of course, you can find more episodes of Decoding TV at podcast.decodingtv.com and find us across all platforms, TikTok, Instagram, Threads, YouTube, Twitch, at Decoding TV. Follow us all over the place. And thanks to all of the paid members at decodingtv.com who make this podcast possible. He is Patrick Klepek. I'm David Chen. Until next time, we got One Piece coming out soon. We just did a how-to with John Wilson conversation. Lots more stuff coming out this fall. Be sure to keep it subscribed to Decoding TV. Until next time, see you later. Goodbye.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.